Thursday, September 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Barack Obama hopes the U.S. will continue to focus on Asia after his presidency. The United States prepares to remember the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks.
And there is something about art that connects with an immediacy that really nothing else does.
And we hear about an alarm clock that has a unique way of waking you up. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama wrapped up his visit to Laos Thursday by telling Southeast Asian leaders the United States will continue to stand with the people of the region. Obama spoke to reporters after a meeting of leaders from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas is traveling with the president, and she tells me about his comments at the news conference.
Well, I think that he would like to see the rebalance continue beyond his presidency. And it's still a question, because clearly there are still some issues. He brought up the tensions in the South China Sea and how the U.S. is with its allies, especially with regard to this latest ruling at The Hague that ruled essentially against China's territorial claims in this very important waterway, saying that it's really international waters and everyone should be able to navigate there. So there's some key questions that are still open. There is a passage of a ratification of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that has not moved through Congress yet, and that is the economic foundation of the pivot. So he was hopeful. He said he was proud of the engagements that have happened during his presidency, but it seemed to also clearly there was still a lot of work to be done, and he said that. He's also a little bit pensive because he grew up in this region. And he talked about how much it has all meant to him personally and how he's mindful that this was his last time as president in this region.
Did he speak about North Korea?
He did. He gravely concerned about these continued missile launches, and he talked about working with China. He feels that China is still not doing enough, could do more to put pressure on North Korea to stop this. So they were... When I say they, President Obama was speaking of the U.S. and South Korea and other allies in the region. We're going to do everything they could to protect the allies, first and foremost, to really look at ways to the greatest degree, toughen sanctions against North Korea. So there was definitely real concern, and it sounded like they were going to round everybody up again and take some tougher action. That's just the way it sounded to me. But yeah, North Korea is another big one today.
Mr. Obama also spoke about the U.S. detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He had resolved to close that during his administration, and there still are, I believe, about 60 detainees still there. What did Mr. Obama have to say about that?
Well, that's correct, and he has fewer than 5 months left in office. He says, I'm not yet willing to concede that the facility will be open beyond my presidency, that we are going to close it during my presidency. He hasn't given up, in other words. He says we're shrinking the population, we're continuing to shrink the population, and he's not ready to say it's not going to happen on my watch. Not at all.
That's VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas in Laos. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we go from the current president to the people who hope to be the next president, namely Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, appearing last night at the Commander-in-Chief Forum, where they talked about international security issues and defense issues. Now, this is kind of a precursor to the debates that are coming up, although they didn't appear on stage at the same time. They spoke to Hillary Clinton first and then Donald Trump. But a lot of moments from this debate being called out on social media, Donald Trump saying that the generals in the U.S. have been reduced to rubble, some of the responses that Hillary Clinton gave about her emails, and a lot of criticism for Matt Lauer, the moderator, saying that he went too soft on some questions, he didn't follow up on others. So people hoping that the debate is a little better than this first kind of foray into the back and forth between the two candidates on a stage. Another person looking to become president is Libertarian Party candidate Gary Johnson, and he had a bit of a slip-up this morning when he was asked on a morning show about the situation in Aleppo. And he said, what is Aleppo? And he didn't seem to know what that was. Of course, Aleppo in Syria, where this refugee crisis is originating, where a lot of this fighting is originating. So a lot of people saying that he's disqualified himself, and he's, I think, taken to social media and tried to walk it back a little bit, but it's a pretty damaging moment for him. But we always like to end with something light and nice. And
yes, we need that.
So we need that for sure. And so we end with hashtag Star Trek 50, because of September 8th, 1966 was the premiere for Star Trek. So 50 years of Star Trek in its different iterations and forms, including some films released recently. And a lot of fans out there doing, you know, the live long and prosper, the Vulcan kind of hand thing, which I'm doing now, but nobody can see it because we're on the radio. But yeah, a lot of fandom. So happy birthday, 50th birthday, big anniversary for Star Trek.
Yeah, and I remember watching that original show. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton blasts her Republican rival Donald Trump for comments he made about Russian President Vladimir Putin. Afghan officials say they've repulsed a major Taliban assault. Turkey arrests more generals and businessmen, and two more people are detained among the ongoing Paris car bomb probe. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The emergence and rapid growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, known as superbugs, have become a serious worldwide health concern. Most scientists have placed the blame in the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the overuse of antibiotics. The WHO says that without urgent coordinated action, the world is heading toward a post-antibiotic era in which common infections and minor injuries that have been treatable for decades can once again kill. Now, researchers writing in an American Chemical Society journal have found a link between antimicrobial substances in household dust and higher levels of a gene that's been associated with resistance to multiple antibiotic drugs. The scientists say their findings suggest that further investigation is needed to define the role of dust laced with antimicrobial products and the rise of antibiotic resistance. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. A new alarm clock that will appeal to your nose. This Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks against the United States that killed almost 3,000 people. Here in Washington, the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History will hold a one-day-only display of material related to the attacks. I spoke with Cedric Yeh, the deputy chair of the Division of Armed Forces History, about the exhibit.
Back in 2001, late 2001, Congress had designated the Smithsonian and the National Museum of American History the repository for September 11th and charged us with preserving the memory of what happened on that day. So on the anniversaries, we do our best to tell the story of what happened, and each one is a little bit different. It depends on what's available resource-wise and how we can best get the story out. And in this case, we decided that a limited affair would be better. We're looking into the future. We're thinking about how to discuss the collections as a whole as we approach the 20th anniversary, to talk about how collecting and preserving the memories of September 11th has changed over the course of the last 15 years, last 20 years. But for the time being, limited events provide people an opportunity to see. It increases the specialness of the collection.
And what are some of the items that will that are contained in this exhibit?
We have collections from each one of the attack sites. We have objects from the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and from Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So for this one-day event, I will have, say, for instance, at the World Trade Center, we will have uniforms of the first responders and of the recovery effort. I have helmets worn by iron workers who came from near and far to help with the clearing of the rubble, at first to look for survivors, then later just to clear the space. I have the uniform of Salvation Army employee. This object is, you know, we want to talk about not just like the for the recovery effort. Yes, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people at Ground Zero looking to clear the space, to be able to find the remains, to find evidence to work, but who was taking care of them, who was feeding them, who was clothing them, and the Salvation Army was there. For the Pentagon, we have office items. We have everyday things that you might find in your desk, in someone else's office. We have name plaques. We have clocks. The idea here is to show that this happened to all of us. And for Shanksville, we have objects from the plane itself. We have pieces of fuselage. We have seat belts, window shades, to once again, in this case, talk about the destruction, talk about the impact, the violence, and to remind people once again that, you know, these recognize, like the airplane window shade, the seat belt, that these are common items that we're all aware of, that these are things that, you know, represent how this occurred to everyday Americans, to all of us.
That's Cedric Yeh, the deputy chair of the Division of Armed Forces History. Well, meanwhile, at the National September 11th Memorial and Museum at Ground Zero in New York City, an art exhibit opens Monday that showcases works about the tragedy. Alice Greenwald is the museum's director, and she describes exhibit.
In anticipating the 15th anniversary of the attacks, so many of us were thinking about the kind of distinction between then and now, you know, where we were then, where we are now. And we just thought it would be so interesting to think back to where we were then, but through the lens of art. All of us reacted on that day, profound shock, profound grief, disbelief, all of those feelings mixed together, and fear, all of it. And, you know, time passes and those feelings are not quite as vivid, but we remember where we were. We remember the moment so clearly. And there is something about art that connects with an immediacy that really nothing else does. And artists, like everyone, responded on 9/11. They had those feelings. They had those reactions. But because they are artists, they turn to their practice, to their craft, to try to make sense of what they saw with their eyes but could not believe they were seeing, and tried to come to terms with it in ways that now communicate so powerfully and emotionally and vividly to all of us.
Now, how did you select the artists and the works of art to be contained in this exhibit?
You know, like any exhibition, it was a process, and we never intended, we didn't start out thinking this was going to be a kind of survey of 9/11 response art or anything like that. We were looking at works, we sort of set a few different kinds of criteria for us. We were looking for established artists, people who already had an artistic practice of one kind or another, because we really did want to see how artists used their work and their methodology and their craft, their forms of expression, to make sense of something all of us were struggling to make sense of. So that was one thing. We were looking for established artists. We were looking for people, artists who had a direct personal connection to the events on 9/11. And what we meant by that were people who perhaps lost a loved one, a family member or a close friend on 9/11, or artists whose studios were located in the vicinity of the World Trade Center. So, and in some cases, these artists lost their studios. Their studios were destroyed or damaged, you know, with the crashing in of debris through their windows, or people who witnessed it literally with their own eyes, you know, were in New York and in Lower Manhattan and ran to their rooftops and watched the events unfold. So we were looking for that kind of direct personal encounter and established artists. And little by little, you know, our curators obviously have been tracking response art, art created in response to 9/11 for some time now, for over a decade. And they went through their, you know, their files and their imagery, and they did their research. And little by little, a show emerged that now includes 13 artists in various media. I mean, we have paintings, we have works on paper, we have multimedia, we have sculpture. And each of them in their own right is unique and compelling and insightful and emotional. But there is something about these works that they seem to converse with one another. And part of what happened in the curatorial journey that we were on is that we began to see commonalities among some of these works and some of these artists. For example, there was a preoccupation among many of them with the blue sky that day, or the sky itself, and how the sky changed. You know, there was that, what they call the severe clear blue of 9/11. It was so clear that day and so vividly blue. And some of the artists referenced that.
That's Alice Greenwald. She's the director of the National September 11th Memorial and Museum in New York City. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
This is International Edition. For coffee drinkers, the day doesn't really begin until there's at least the smell of a freshly brewed pot. Now there's an alarm clock that can give you that pleasant aroma even before drinking the first cup. VOA's Deborah Block tells us all about it.
Does this remind you of how you usually start your day? Instead of that beep or other annoying sounds, now there's SensorWake, an alarm clock that releases different aromas into the air to gradually wake you up. The French inventor, who says he hates mornings, built the prototype in his garage a couple of years ago.
We use polymer beads in the capsule with scents, and an airflow will do an emission of scents because it will pass through the capsules and it will diffuse the scents to the user in the bed.
Scents like espresso, peppermint, and cut grass that last for 15 minutes.
You just have to insert the capsule in the alarm clock with the scents you want, for example, mint. And in the morning, you have a scent emission, and in 3 minutes, it will be strong enough to wake you up in a good mood with your favorite aroma.
Users can also pick the smell of toast or croissants, chocolate, and even a seaside aroma. Each capsule can be used 30 times. Our sense of smell actually closes down during sleep, but the strong scents wake up most people within a couple of minutes. But what if they don't?
If you have, for example, a blocked nose, or you are in a very deep sleep, for example, an hangover, you will have a backup melody after 3 minutes.
SensorWake says the alarm clock will bring pleasant emotions and sweet memories every morning. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that sounds like a rather pleasant way to wake up. That's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Authorities in Venezuela have again imprisoned opposition leader Daniel Ceballos. Mr. Ceballos, the former mayor of the western city of San Cristobal, had been released from prison last year and placed under house arrest for health reasons. He was arrested in March 2014 for allegedly inciting violence during protests against food shortages, high inflation, and rampant crime. Mr. Ceballos carried out a hunger strike in May and June of 2015 to demand that the government release political prisoners and set a date for legislative elections. On June 3rd of that year, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights publicly requested that the government provide medical attention to and release Daniel Ceballos, as well as political prisoners Leopoldo Lopez, Raul Emilio Baduel, and Alexander Tirado, who were also on a hunger strike. On August 11, 2015, authorities released Ceballos to house arrest. On August 27th, just days before national demonstrations for political and economic reforms were to take place, the Venezuelan government revoked his house arrest and in the middle of the night transferred him to prison. Opposition leaders believe Mr. Ceballos is a political prisoner and his arrest was an effort to quash dissent. In a press statement issued August 28th, John Kirby, U.S. State Department spokesperson, said, "The United States is deeply disturbed by the Venezuelan government's decision to move opposition leader Daniel Ceballos from house arrest to prison. Mr. Ceballos' transfer to prison represents an effort to intimidate and impede the Venezuelan people's right to peacefully express their opinion. We condemn it and call for Mr. Ceballos' immediate release. The basic underpinnings of the rule of law in Venezuela have degraded to an alarming degree. There is no place in a democratic society for employing the instruments of the state to bully, intimidate, and silence the political opposition." The September 1st marches proceeded largely without incident, but Mr. Ceballos and others detained in the days leading up to them remain incarcerated. Further, the government deported or barred entry to at least six international journalists who had planned to cover the demonstrations. On September 3rd, the government detained journalist Braulio Jatar on Isla Margarita after he published news of a local anti-Maduro protest on his Margarita-based website, Reporte Confidencial. The United States is deeply concerned by the detentions and restrictions on press freedom before and after the march and the ongoing serious human rights issues in Venezuela.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the Voice of America.